From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. With just a few days left in the 80s, we continue our week-long retrospective of interviews from the Fresh Air archives. Today we feature two offbeat actors who made their mark on the decade. Actor and writer Spalding Gray tells us about his pursuit of the perfect moment. And we hear one of the last interviews given by the actor Divine before his death in 1988. Divine was often described as a 300-pound transvestite, but he thought of himself as a character actor who was often called on to play the part of women. Plus, rock historian Ed Ward turns the clock back 10 years, and book critic John Leonard reviews the new book by explorer Thor Heyerdahl. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bill Redlin. Nicolae Ceaușescu was apparently unrepentant until the end. Romanian television showed film today of the former dictator at the trial which ordered his execution and that of his wife. The film shows Ceaușescu arguing angrily with the army tribunal and saying in a loud voice, "I do not recognize this court. Read the Constitution." An off-screen voice answers, "We've read the Constitution. We know it better than you." An interrogator asks on the film who ordered the shooting of the people. Ceaușescu's response, "I will answer nothing, I will sign nothing, I will not recognize this court." The highly trained fighters who remained loyal to the late president were reported to be surrendering today after Romanian television showed Ceaușescu and his wife Elena's bodies following their execution. President Alan Garcia of Peru said today that his government never considered offering political asylum to General Manuel Noriega of Panama. Mark Day reports from Lima.
Garcia is apparently backtracking from a statement he made Monday to a group of foreign reporters. Garcia remarked during a Christmas morning breakfast meeting that asylum can't be denied to anybody, even to a man like Noriega. Those remarks have provoked a storm of protest from opposition party members here, who insist that Noriega is a common criminal and a bandit, not a political refugee. Garcia is one of the strongest critics of the U.S. invasion of Panama. He withdrew his ambassador from Washington a week ago, and he is refusing to attend a drug summit with President George Bush scheduled for next month in Cartagena, Colombia. Garcia said Monday that he must have been naive to assume President Bush would improve relations with Latin America. For National Public Radio, I'm Mark Day in Lima, Peru.
In Lebanon, Israeli jet fighters destroyed the headquarters of the Lebanese Communist Party south of Beirut just hours after Israeli commandos launched a rare ground and air offensive against guerrilla bases in the south. At least five guerrillas were killed and 19 wounded in the two attacks. Mike Theodoulou reports from Nicosia, Cyprus.
It's not clear why Israel launched its second raid. It might have felt that the first was not successful, but it's more likely it wanted to humiliate the communists who have repeatedly attacked Israeli troops in its self-declared security zone in the south. The first attack displayed Israeli military muscle and its daring. 100 commandos stormed two villages used by various guerrilla groups, while helicopters dropped paratroopers into a third village where they attacked a communist command center. The second raid was far more typical. Jet fighters destroyed their target, the communist headquarters, within minutes. But both raids showed little respect for Lebanon's sovereignty. And they came at a time of widespread misery in the south, where thousands of civilians have fled vicious fighting these last 4 days between rival Shiite militias. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodoulou in Nicosia.
Kabul radio says Afghan rebels launched an intense round of rocket barrages on the capital today, killing 8 people and wounding 6. The broadcast said the rebels fired 30 U.S.-made missiles into residential areas. This is NPR News. A county sheriff says the man who was driving the pickup truck in which baseball figure Billy Martin was killed may face manslaughter charges. Broome County Sheriff Anthony Rufo says the district attorney will consider vehicular manslaughter or criminally negligent homicide charges against 53-year-old Bill Reedy after laboratory tests determine his blood alcohol level. Reedy has already been charged with driving while intoxicated in the wake of the crash on Christmas Day. New York Mayor Ed Koch, speaking at the last press conference of his 12-year term in office, says his biggest regret is that his administration was seen as insensitive to blacks. Jim Zaroli reports from New York.
Koch made no apologies for his handling of minority issues. He said he believed his efforts to include blacks in city government were never fully appreciated or understood. But Koch also used the press conference to criticize South African Bishop Desmond Tutu, a well-known civil rights leader who will be a featured speaker at the inauguration of David Dinkins as mayor next Monday. Koch criticized Bishop Tutu for a series of pro-Palestinian statements he made during a visit to Israel this week. He said Tutu had criticized Israel for human rights abuses while ignoring more serious offenses by other countries. But Koch also said he has no objection to Tutu appearing at the inauguration. For National Public Radio, this is Jim Zaroli in New York.
An appellate court in Brooklyn has overturned misdemeanor riot convictions against three teenagers in connection with the Howard Beach racial attack. A black man was killed in the attack. The decision by the Brooklyn Appellate Court was handed down December 11th and reported in today's New York Post. Three other youths were convicted in a separate trial on manslaughter and assault charges. A group of white males attacked several blacks on December 20th of 1986. One of the black men, Michael Griffith, was chased onto a busy highway, hit by a car, and killed. The three defendants whose convictions were overturned were acquitted of a more serious felony riot charge. I'm Bill Redlin, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're ending the decade by digging into the Fresh Air archives and picking out some interviews from the 80s that we think you'll enjoy. Today we hear from actor and writer Spalding Gray. Gray has influenced the development of theater in the 80s with his comic autobiographical monologues. The monologues have made his private life public, chronicling everything from every bed he slept in during one period of his life to his problems remembering his lines during the making of the film The Killing Fields, in which he had a small part as an American diplomat. But the real subject of Gray's stories are his own neuroses and metaphysical doubts. At the start of the decade, Gray was unknown outside the experimental theater world. Now, at the end of the decade, he's appeared in several films, including Beaches with Bette Midler, David Byrne's True Stories, and the Jonathan Demme-directed film of the monologue Swimming to Cambodia. Gray even had a bad guy part on an episode of Spencer for Hire on TV. His retrospective of monologues was held over at Lincoln Center. He co-starred on Broadway in a revival of Our Town, and he had a book of monologues published called Sex and Death to the Age of 14. The interview we're going to hear was recorded in 1986, when Gray was performing his monologue, The Terrors of Pleasure. In it, he describes how he took a shot at the big time by going to Los Angeles to audition for high-paying TV roles. He needed money to finance a new foundation for the country house he bought, which he just discovered was collapsing. In this part, Gray is describing his screen test for a made-for-TV movie. The director, Simon, and his co-star, Sandy, are both TV veterans. Spalding and Sandy are doing a take of their big love scene.
We were supposed to have just finished making love, and we are now lying naked under the blankets in front of the fire. I am supposed to get out my sketch pad and begin to sketch Dale. Simon put down a paisley spread and asked Sandy and me to get comfortable on it. The honeymoon scene went something like this. Scott, got your eyes full, honey? What are you looking at? Dale. You. Scott. What do you want? Dale. You. Scott. But you've already had me. Dale. Not enough. Never enough. Then I'm supposed to move in on her and sing, a kiss is just a kiss. In her ear, right? And we kiss and collapse in laughter. I really try to find my way into the character. I'm using my notebook as a sketch pad, and I'm holding a paperclip. I'm pretending it's a piece of charcoal. I'm just sketching away as we grow through these lines. All of a sudden, Simon yells, cut, cut, stop, stop, Spalding. The sketch pad is just a prop. Don't worry about it. You really want Dale. And I said, slightly taken aback, because I thought I was in character, oh, you mean I'm not really an artist? Because any artist would rather sketch than make love.
As you may have guessed, Spalding Gray didn't get that part. The role was so unlike what he usually did on stage. I asked him if he had done any roles in the past that had prepared him for the audition.
It was like the kind of scene work I had done in college, where I was thinking of myself then as a young romantic lead. And I was really trying to go back and play this painter that I was supposed to be, and she was supposed to be my model, New England painter. And I was very sincere And I was not bad. I saw the video of it. The director was supposed to send me the raw video footage, and he freaked. He was afraid that I would do something with it publicly, even though I promised I wouldn't, because he was just afraid of being exposed. But I saw those video playbacks, and a lot of what I did was very dramatic, very intense, but one of the interesting things that I noticed was that my face was totally alive, like amoebic, like protein, all moving and shifting, and my mouth was so expressive, and I'd be touching myself. And I realized that TV people know how to keep a still face so you can project the emotion on them. They are like Zen, in Zen meditation. They don't, and my face was just crawling. And I thought, that would be weird on TV. It wouldn't work. I could understand why when they saw the video.
I'm really not convinced that you could do well on a sitcom.
I don't think I could.
Because you do some of the lines that you had to do readings of,
right,
in your monologue, and those lines are just so absurd. They're just so ultra television.
I can't
imagine
help
it.
You can't but taking off on them. Mm-hmm. You know? For me, I mean, I couldn't help but doing them ironically. I can't resist finding the humor in the situation.
So you still, I mean, it looks like you can really do this on your own terms, you know, that you could do acting and movies
terms. It always works. It is always works when the director has come to me and not auditioned me. I'm very bad at auditions. I'm very bad under pressure. It's when the director sees when the director has the vision to see in me what they can use.
Did this hatred of auditions and contribute to your leaving, at least temporarily leaving, acting, stage acting?
Well, I went into the underground theater really in 1970 when I joined the performance group. And I would say that probably the audition thing and the whole high-pressure thing and the need to be a part of a group to nurture a way of working, all of those things were playing into it. But as I do say in the monologue, Terrors of Pleasure, I talk about how I would come into, I would always have the fantasy that I was the only actor up for the role. I mean, I knew I wasn't, but it was a fantasy, you know. And you come into that waiting room, and no one knows you from anyone else there when I was just starting out. And you start looking around at these people and you want to kill these other actors. You know, all of that competition comes up. And then the other side of it is, oh, God, look at that guy. You know, he could do it just as well. Or he could do it better. Or who am I? You know, what am I bringing special to this situation? And I had to go find my own specialness. And I've taken a long, circuitous route, and I'm ready to come back, and I'm ready to do films. I don't think I'm ready to do plays anymore. Theater, although I occasionally go to it, theater doesn't interest me as much as film.
Why is it?
Because film, for me, is going in and framing the real world. And theater is going into a space that refers to itself. It's a theatrical space. And I worked in theater for so long, in the performing garage, in some traditional plays, in a lot of experimental plays. And I called it the windowless art house. What excited me in The Killing Fields was being out in what you would call a normal, relatively normal, natural environment, everyday plays, and watching how it's framed and made into special time by the film.
Did you ever have the urge to play Hamlet and, you know, do Chekhov, mm-hmm, do the great,
mm-hmm,
roles?
Mm-hmm. Way back when I was in college, and I acted in every play over 4 years at Emerson College, and I just was sure that was my life was going to be an actor. When I got out, I was going to do, I had done scenes from Hamlet, I was going to act in regional theater, and I wanted to do Chekhov. I wanted to do I had been in a couple of productions at the Seagull. I wouldn't want to do Astroff and Uncle Vanya. And now I've lost it. The most recent offer was to play Dr. Dorn for Larry Sacro's production of The Seagull at Birdcliff Theater with Joanne Woodward, who was playing Madame Arkadina. And it was a choice between that and playing my own work at the Goodman Theater, and I went for my own work. And I keep saying I want to get back to the stage. And I said, well, I would play Polonius if it was Spalding Gray in a plaid shirt and dungarees trying to remember Polonius's lines. You see, I have a real battle with lines. I think it's a part of my dyslexia.
Dyslexia?
I have mild dyslexia. And it's not as... I know there are worse cases where you see where words are just abstract. But if I try to read too fast, the letters begin to bounce around and I'll see saw as was. So I'm a slow reader, dyslexia. And therefore, I digest very well. But if I can't do a cold reading, in an audition. And even if I have the text in front of me, it bounces around.
It's really hard to believe because I'm not saying I distrust you or anything, but you do your performances so swiftly. I mean, you talk so quickly when you want to.
Yeah.
And you have the whole thing more or less memorized, and it's staggering because it's maybe like a 90-minute or 60-minute monologue.
No,
I know you've got your notes, but
yeah,
you don't really look at them that much.
There's a difference between memorizing. That's an interesting point. I cannot memorize a text that someone else has written and get it right every night. I even with Sam Shepard's Tooth of Crime, the director was always taking notes on that. But I can speak my pieces, which are not memorized, but I'm seeing a film. When I'm telling those stories, I am clearly seeing the film of those stories. So I'm really describing what's coming into my mind. If it had to be memorized, I couldn't do it.
Right, so you don't have to get it word for word, and no one's got to follow, you know, get their cue from you so that they can say
their lines. The pressure's not on me. I don't function well under pressure. That's part of why I'm not out there grabbing the big film roles.
We're listening to an interview with actor and writer Spalding Gray, recorded in 1986. This is part of a series of interviews from our archives, which we're running during this final week of the decade. We'll be back with more after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Let's get back to our interview with actor and writer Spalding Gray, recorded in 1986.
In fleshing out your onstage Spalding Gray character, has that brought you in touch with different parts of yourself that were maybe not very developed before?
The humor, definitely. I really got my sense of humor when I came to New York City, and that was a combination of you've got to laugh to be in that place, and the other was being exposed to Judaism on a large scale like that, and finally having a Jewish girlfriend.
Oh.
No, that wasn't funny. They have a great sense of humor, and they're very extroverted. And I had grown up with introverted wasps who have this very dry sense of humor, which is a sense of humor. I'm not saying that it's not there, but there was a certain broadness that I discovered through being in New York and being exposed to that in people. And so there's that. And the other thing that I have been able to do is to travel and to be alone now that I'm a writer, or now that I know that it can be material. And before, I really used to disappear a lot, just feeling very anxious about being in a place where no one recognized me. And since I've been learned how to take notes, there's an aspect of me, the writer, that recognizes the other, the person, Spalding Gray. There's a very clear schism now, where I'm always watching my life for experiences that can be used, and sometimes creating the experiences, which I make a joke about in the monologue, where I say, uh-oh, did I buy this house in order to make this monologue, because now it's come full circle. I was in Cambridge performing last year, and a woman who's reviewing a very academic book on postmodern theater, she said, you know, I thought I couldn't include you in my book. And now I've seen your monologue about the house, and I now know that you're a postmodernist writer in this sense, and she had this all theoretical, right? There's some a French semiotic philosopher who says that the sign of postmodernism is that the act, the map of the act exists before the event. He uses nuclear war as an example to say that we know where the nuclear war is going to be fought. It's all on computer. And this is a postmodern condition. And she said, you bought that house in order to make the monologue, therefore you're a postmodernist. And now you can be in my book.
So you're going to be in it. So does this mean that before you came to New York, you were a very kind of like serious artist, that you weren't funny?
Yeah. No sense of humor at all. No sense of humor. In fact, I can remember an old girlfriend that I had. She had been a girlfriend at Emerson College, and then she came to visit me in New York after I'd been living there for about 2 years. And a bunch of us were sitting around, and she was just seeing me for the first time in a long time. And afterwards, she said, I didn't know you were funny. You were funny. You were making me laugh. You were never funny when I knew you. What happened? No, that was really heavy. Really. Oh, God. When I was at Emerson College, I would go to sleep at 10 o'clock every night listening to Dylan Thomas read Fernhill. That would be my tranquilizer.
I mean, how do you get to be funny? I understand what exposed you to humor and everything, but I always think of humor as being something you're either, you know, born with or not, in a way. It's not something you can... The deadliest people are the people who decide, well, I think I ought to add a little humor to my life.
You know, I think it was there with me, and I think it went underground when... It was there with me in high school. I was a real clown, cutting up a lot, blah, blah, blah. But I think it went underground during that heavy puberty time. And it was just, I turned into this really kind of existentially death-obsessed poet in college with just morbid.
Was that really good for getting girls, by the way?
No, it wasn't.
It wasn't, really?
No. I was really, truly disturbed. I didn't have many girlfriends in college, not until my senior year. No, I was into suffering. I was really into suffering, and I lived in an alley because I took the cheapest apartment I could find, you know, to help my father out, and I was working as the janitor there, and it was $35 a month because I was emptying trash, and this alley was filled with rats in Boston because they have these, and you could only enter into the apartment from the alley. We called it Rat Alley, and no one would come to visit me. You can imagine a girl coming there in any hour. Well, at night, I'd have to come home clapping my hands. Then the rats would scurry out of the way. No kidding. I was like Edgar Allan Poe, morbid. And, you know, I had to enter into my apartment directly from the street, which meant there was no entranceway. A rat could have scurried right in there. So I didn't have any girlfriends, freshman, sophomore. I mean, it was Emerson College. Most of them were Jewish women up from New York who were into musical comedy and laughs. I mean, I was playing the wrong role. If I had been at Harvard and was acting that way, maybe it would have been different.
You know, one of the things that you really use your humor for so well is describing your own neurosis, which happens to be similar to neuroses that a lot of us have. And it makes it seem, it's so effortless and everything when you're on stage, and it makes it seem like, wow, neuroses aren't that bad. They're really pretty funny. And in fact, they're not funny to have them at all. It's funny to describe them when you're funny at it.
Mm.
But do your like problems ever strike you as being funny at the time?
No, they don't. It's not an overly painful situation, but it's an annoying situation because it's a repeat of... It gets boring because it's a repeat. The same neuroses keep coming back, and you get bored with it, and you think, now, wait a minute. Can I... You know, it's going to be a point where I just can't turn these into monologues any longer. Oh, maybe you can. Woody Allen's able to do one a year, you know, a film a year. I should be able to do a monologue a year if you have enough variety and setting and change it. But I think, you know, for instance, one of my problems is like taking a vacation, the neurosis about the vacation, and being able to just unwind and do nothing. And I did a little journalism in Australia and earned some extra money and decided I had always wanted to go to Bali, and I was going to go there and I was going to relax. And I got there and I started freaking out the first couple of days I was there. And then three people recognized me on the street of Ubud when I was in the art center. And so they were kind of leading me into this art community there. And I was starting to touch down, you know, finding myself in the landscape. And I got relaxed after about 5 days. And I said, now I'm going to go a little bit further. I saw all these people on motorcycles. You know, I said, I am going to rent a motorcycle and take a trip, a pleasurable trip up to this beautiful beach on the East Coast. Now I'm going to go a little bit further, and I got real nervous about all of this. I mean, it was a chaotic day, you know, because I could feel the neurosis coming on. And to avoid drinking a lot, I'd been going in cocktail hour. Every cocktail hour, I go to a Balinese healer, a Balian, who was a wonderful man who was laughing all the time at me. He thought, because originally I went there and told him I was in three places at once, and he said he had never had anyone come in with that disease. Maybe I should get a shot, you know, of something. He wanted to send me away. Then he got out these magical drawings that his grandfather had done, pencil drawings, and we went through it to try to find a drawing that would fit my condition. So we get out this beautiful drawing of this guy with no head and four legs, and his eyes are in his chest. So the healer does a mantra about that, you know, and does a copy of it for me. He copies it, and I have to have this picture over my bed. Then I told him that I thought part of why I couldn't take a vacation, why I was so riled up, was because my mother committed suicide when I was taking a vacation in Mexico, you know, in the summer, and that this is coming back on me. It was kind of Freudian theory. Oh, yes, he understood this. Now, he spoke very little English, but he understood what I was saying. And he did a whole ceremony for my mother's spirit, and we picked out a drawing for her, and he was going to lay her spirit to rest. His wife made an offering and the whole thing, you know, and he did a mantra. It was very powerful for me. And then I ate the offering and I thought, now I've got a drawing that says total protection. My mother's spirit is laid to rest. I'm going to take this motorcycle, you know, up to this beach and I'm going to have a good time, right? And he told me the day to travel on. By the way, he got down the Balinese calendar. Now, it took me so long to get the motorcycle together and to get everything going that I could tell night was coming on. It was a two-hour trip up to this beach. And I thought, now, maybe I should travel tomorrow when I'm fresh, you know? And he said, no, he said it was a bad day to travel tomorrow. I've got to go today. So I'm off, and it's a great trip, and everything is fine. But night falls in those countries near the equator, like, whoosh, just there. It's been 98 degrees, and all of a sudden it's night, and I'm riding in a kind of damp T-shirt and shorts on this motorcycle, and I can feel this cold coming on. I mean, it came on within a minute, you know, and I ended up with this unbelievable head cold on this most idyllic beach, you know. So I knew it was subconscious. I couldn't even get a hold of that. You know, that was the angering part. I had everything consciously worked out, you know. Oh, God, that was so, I lay on that beach so depressed, and it was so idyllic, and it was so beautiful. Of course, beauty terrifies me.
You'll never be that prepared for a vacation again.
I know, everything. I mean, exactly. It was, everything was pointed toward ecstasy. Everything.
So what's holding you back from letting go and enjoying yourself?
We don't know, do we? Because that unconscious let the cold in. Imagine catching a cold in Bali, come on. At 98 degrees, a head cold. It's like a nightmare. I feel like I have a fever all the time.
One of the things that's held together a lot of your monologues is an obsession with the perfect moment, with finding the perfect moment. Where does that come from? When did you first start wanting the perfect moment?
See, I always wanted it and didn't know. I didn't have a name for it. In fact, both my older brother and I both have had cravings for that, particularly Rocky, my older brother. And I don't know what it came from, something to do with the relationship to my mother, who was constantly questing for ecstatic states. She was very concerned with that. And I've always been concerned with all mood changes. My ally is alcohol. That produces the mood change that I feel best with. And I have to be very careful with it because it's an ally. I don't want it to work against me. When I first conceived of the word was reading, when I first adopted the word, was reading a book on Sartre, Sartre's works. It was an analysis of nausea. And they kept referring to Sartre's idea of the perfect moment being the bourgeois concept of when the bourgeois or ego gets in a place where everything seems to revolve around it is the perfect moment, when raw, indifferent nature coincides with the human ego. And the imperfect moment could also be a perfect moment. I mean, to lose that ego, which I've also experienced, and that is another perfect moment. But usually it's when all the elements agree with you.
Have you had any?
And have I? Oh, yeah. I talk about it in swimming to Cambodia in the Indian Ocean. When I was doing Killing Fields, you know, when I just melded with the ocean, it was very beautiful. I've had some near-perfect ones in Australia, but, you know, my brother Rocky is looking for them, and I can remember he married late, and his wife is one of those really, she had been married before, really down-to-earth Jewish mother types, and he teaches at a boys' school, and he came home one day and went, oh, God, I haven't had an ecstatic moment in days. And she said, what? What did you say? An ecstatic woman? How many of those do you expect to have in a lifetime? She just laid into him, you know. And the two of us are always going around like that, you know, just dreaming, like, when's it going to come next? I don't know what that has to do with. It's some sort of two-year-old consciousness.
Actor and writer Spalding Gray, as recorded in 1986. More interviews from the Fresh Air Archives next time when we hear from composers John Cage and David Del Tredici. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our series of interviews from the Fresh Air archives. The character actor Divine was best known for his roles as Women, the filthiest woman alive in Pink Flamingos, and a beleaguered housewife and mother in Hairspray. Coming up, we hear one of the last interviews Divine recorded before his death in 1988. Also, rock historian Ed Ward looks back at the music scene at the start of the decade, and book critic John Leonard reviews Easter Island, The Mystery Solved, the latest book from Norwegian explorer Thor Heyerdahl. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. Pro-democracy reformers in Romania named a new government today, and the provisional government said free general elections will be held in April. The country's new president has defended yesterday's execution of dictator Nicolae Ceaușescu. Ion Iliescu said that after a trial, a quick execution was necessary because Ceaușescu's loyalists were plotting a rescue attempt. NPR's John Hockenberry is in Bucharest and reports things are starting to settle down.
It's been one of the quietest days in Bucharest in really the last five. Only sporadic gunfire all day long, and the evening has yet to really erupt in the way it's been doing. People are beginning to come to grips with what the future means now that Ceaușescu has been executed and his pictures have been shown on television. People are really concerned that the Committee for National Salvation is maybe a little too dominant and is monopolizing the control of the new interim government. But it's also clear that it's very critical for the government to take steps very, very quickly to take control of a very volatile, very fluid situation on the streets of Bucharest and in some of the more tense towns in the outlying areas.
NPR's John Hockenberry. The Pentagon said today that the use of the stealth fighter to strike an airfield in Panama was a success. Pete Williams, a Pentagon spokesman, declined to say what kind of explosives were dropped on the field and how many of the airplanes took part in the attack. Officials say military commanders considered but discarded other missions for the radar-evading airplane in the Panamanian military intervention. Last week's intervention was the first time the plane was used in a combat role. While diplomats are discussing the fate of Manuel Noriega, whether he'll be tried or allowed safe passage to a third country, the U.S. government is going after his assets. Justice Department spokesman David Runkle says requests are going out to foreign governments for a freeze on money believed earned from drug trafficking by Noriega.
The drug business has become of greater international concern in recent months. And we are getting outstanding cooperation from other countries in dealing with the bank accounts of the drug traffickers.
Runkle says federal agents are going to Panama to inspect records captured at various Noriega offices and residences. The government believes these will help locate even more drug money. Soviet Communist Party leaders are suspending an urgent two-day plenum without acting against the defiant Republic of Lithuania. Instead, party leaders are suggesting President Gorbachev make a trip to the Baltic Republic. Last week, Lithuania's Communist Party voted to split from Moscow. Stock prices were mixed on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 2 points to close at 2709.26. Advances edged declines in light trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. As 1990 barrels toward us, our rock and roll historian Ed Ward pauses to reflect on the music that was happening the last time a new decade began. Here's the first of his two-part report.
When I took on the task of writing these pieces for Fresh Air, I realized early on that I had to put a time limit on the music I was going to discuss to decide what was history and what wasn't, not yet. Arbitrarily, then, I decided there'd be a 10-year wait before something became eligible. What that means right now is that with the dawning of a new decade, 1980 becomes eligible for inclusion. So what did happen in 1980 anyway? Well, Pink Floyd released The Wall, The Stones released Emotional Rescue, and the heavy metal revival started, mostly in England, but it soon swept over here. Led Zeppelin's drummer, John Bonham, died, as did AC/DC's vocalist, Bon Scott. On the other hand, the kids in Live Skull, the current grade school punk band, hadn't been born yet. And as for me, it was my first full year covering rock and roll and pop music for a daily newspaper, which meant I paid attention. In rock and roll, the big news was DOR, or dance-oriented rock. What this meant in practice was that, for one, Blondie, formerly a cheesy Farfisa organ-led pop combo, could rip off the bass line of Chic's Good Times and do a song about rap. It also meant a big boost for some of the more melodically inclined British performers, like Gary Numan, people who felt punk had done pop a disservice.
Here in my car, I feel safest of all. I can lock all my doors. It's the only way to live in cars. Here in my car, I can only receive. I can listen to you. It keeps me stable for dice in cars.
And in the U.S., it meant an outlet for eccentric performers who didn't look towards Britain for role models. Milling around on the floor and slamming that punk had started soon brought the beat back to music that had been consumed with lassitude, or at best a strict backbeat nobody could do much with. Of all the dance music the so-called New Wave came out with that year, my favorite was coming out of the north of England, where the two-tone movement was shaking things up.
Sleep all day.
Reviving the pre-reggae rhythms of ska, these bands were racially integrated, full of fun, and often very politically involved, particularly when it came to British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, whose policies had made a wasteland of their hometowns. But ska wasn't the only music being revived.
The Spanish looking for someone to hold his hand. It doesn't quite, but they understand the meaning. I never heard about Hugs to Wild, but I heard about Brendan Beers. I don't think about Sean O'Casey. We don't care about Bernard Shaw. He doesn't know about New Rule Beck. He won't talk about Gina Neal, Ella O'Brien, and Lawrence Stern.
Kevin Rowland and Dexy's Midnight Runners felt that soul music fit the Anglo-Irish experience and had a number of hits in Britain that, I'm afraid, laid the groundwork for such soul boys as Paul Young and Wham in the years to come. Looking for records for this piece, I realized one thing. 1980 was overwhelmingly a year for singles. The do-it-yourself and forget-being-self-conscious about it ethos of punk had resolved into a torrent of great singles like White Girl by X, or obscurities like Roscoe's Family by No Sisters, or this catchy song about religious cults from an Austin band, Standing Waves, who have passed into history.
You don't have to think, don't worry. 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 Faith is strong.
And there was another song, soon to be recorded in a more coherent version, that really foresaw the future of rock and roll.
I saw your picture in the magazines I read. Imagine footlights on.
be exploring more of 1980 next year.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, and he writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. During this last week of the decade, we're running something of a retrospective featuring interviews from the Fresh Air archives. Coming up, one of the last interviews with the actor Divine, recorded 2 weeks before his sudden death on March 7th, 1988. Divine was frequently referred to as a 300-pound transvestite, but he thought of himself as a character actor who was frequently called on to play women. Divine starred in every one of John Waters' movies. Waters is the filmmaker who elevated bad taste into an art. It was Waters' movie Pink Flamingos that made Divine famous. If you've seen the movie or even the publicity stills, then you'll remember the image of Divine's huge frame covered in a skin-tight, low-cut gown. Divine played the woman who wins the title The Filthiest Person Alive. But by the late 80s, neither Waters nor Divine was interested in that kind of shock value. Divine was trying to broaden his image and play more male roles. In Divine's last movie, Hairspray, directed by John Waters, Divine played two roles, a man and a woman. We talked about the scene from Pink Flamingos Divine was most famous for, one of the most notorious scenes in recent film history. I'm just going to ask you one question about the famous Pink Flamingos scene in which the movie ends, and just one question about it, and then you have to eat a fresh dog turd, and you and John Waters have both said that you did it to kind of get attention, and the film really did. I mean, you were real upcoming people.
Well, John came to me and he said, well, you know, would you do this? I said, oh, sure. I thought he was kidding. And a year later, he said, okay, now tomorrow you have to eat the dog turd. I thought, oh, this is great. He wasn't kidding, you know. And he said, well, listen, do you want to be famous or do you want to be completely forgotten about? He said, it's going to do either one or the other for you. It's going to make you or forget. You said, your name will go down in movie history forever anyway, no matter what you do. And I thought, well, what do I care? You know, I was very young, and you don't think about all these things. And I didn't really think about it until I had to follow that dog around for 3 hours. And finally it went, and it was quite a hideous experience, actually.
Well, here's my question. Did you rush off to an emergency room afterwards?
Well, no, I went home.
That's a silly question, but I'd be wondering about, you know, germs and things like
well,
that.
Well, I know. I had mouthwash and things, and I brushed my teeth and goggled. Anyway, I went home, and I was sitting there. And the more I thought about it, then I started to worry. So I called the hospital, and I'll never forget this. And I didn't know what to tell them, you know, because I was a bit old to run around eating dog feces. You know? So I called and I said, oh, hello, this is Mrs. Johnson and my son just ate dog duty. And what should I do? And she said, well, how old is your son? And I said, well, he's, you know, 24 years old. And well, then the nurse got, she said, some maniac's on the phone here. Her son's 24 and he's eating dogs. So I got back on the phone. She said, well, why? And I had to tell her, well, I said that he was retarded and that we had a dog and he was in the backyard playing with the dog. The dog had gone to the bathroom and he'd eaten the dog mess, you know. So she said, well, you just have to wash his mouth out and, you know, do all this. She said, but feel his stomach every day because he could get what was called the, you know, like a worm, a white worm. And every day I was feeling my stomach to see if it could. Finally, one day it got hard, and I thought, oh, my God, I've got it. But I had hysterical white worms as it was. I didn't have anything. So I was very lucky. But she suggested that I get rid of the dog.
You said that it was John Waters who gave, you know, who helped give you your image.
Right.
How did you decide on what that image was going to be when you first were getting
it
together?
At the time, John wanted a very large woman, because as you had said before, he wanted the exact opposite of what normally would be beautiful. He wanted a 300-pound beauty as opposed to 110-pound beauty. He wanted to, as I've been called, inflated Jane Mansfield. So that's what he got. And also, it's ironic that he would say the most beautiful woman in the world turns out to be a man. So everything there is backwards. So it's really a John Waters character. But then Van Smith, a very good friend of ours, who does all of John's movies, he does the makeup and costuming, and has done off, helped create the look for the character. He's the one that said, go in the bathroom, shave your head halfway back, and pluck all your eyebrows out. So, I mean, you really got to trust people. I went in the bathroom and did this. Came out, and I thought, what have I done now? But then he did my face almost like he always called a beauty gone berserk. And it was similar to kabuki type makeup.
Oh, that's true, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, the work that he does is quite beautiful. And also, we didn't want to look like a normal, everyday woman, because I'm not a woman. We wanted to look more like a cartoon character, you know, of a woman.
You know, John Waters has said that he really has always loved it when people who don't fit mainstream good looks take what they have and really turn it into style, turn it into, you know, an advantage. Did you feel like you were doing that when you were growing up? Because you were, I think you were always pretty heavy.
Yeah, well, no, actually not, because I was very much an introvert, and I never really went out of the house till I was about 16 years old. I was very uptight about my weight and about the way I looked, and always wanted to look like everyone else. And finally, my junior year, like when I was 16 and in high school, is when I really started hanging out with John and everyone else, that I got the confidence together to go out. And I was always in a coat. I always had a raincoat on or something. People probably thought I was a flasher, but I was just uptight about, you know, how fat I was. But at the same time, couldn't or wouldn't do anything about it. Finally, I went on a diet, like I said, my junior year, and lost to 80 pounds and went down to 145 and for my senior year. And then I was able to get dates and go to the prom and everything. But still, it was strange to me, because all of a sudden people talked to me. They wouldn't talk to me when I was fat. And I thought, well, what's this all about? You know, it was a rude awakening, actually, at a very young age.
So it must have been really liberating in a way when you started playing these extravagant roles where your weight was really a part of the role, and you were very theatrical about your size and theatrical about the way you dressed.
Oh, yeah, well, John did help me, I mean, to gain a lot of self-confidence and to be proud not to fit the mold that I think they really do try to put you on, especially here in America, that you've got to be thin, you've got to be, you know, under 200 pounds. And, I mean, you don't. I mean, there are a lot of big people out there that are still very beautiful people, you know. It has, as I think, as long as you're clean and neat, this is fine, you know.
I think when you and Waters started working together, you had a lot of exploits, both in the kinds of movies that you did and in the kind of parties that you gave, and shoplifting, from what I've read. But it seems to me like you were part of this, very kind of avant-garde theatrical type of into a theatrical kind of juvenile delinquency, as opposed to being like the real hoods.
Oh yeah, we weren't really bad, you know. I think we were just bored and. We were young teenagers from your upper middle class families with nothing to do. I mean, I think the movies actually grew out of that situation also.
Mm-hmm.
But when we were making movies, we were locking each other in the trunks of our convertible cars and letting our friends out at the drive-in movies. And we'd drink a beer every now and then, which was I guess could be one of the worst things we ever did. We were never into any heavy drug scenes or into anything really, like I said, really bad that we would have to go to jail for, except a few bits of shoplifting. But I mean, all the kids did it, and basically we were good kids.
How did the tough guys in the school treat you, the people who really were the hoods?
Oh, well, they used to wait for me every day to beat me up after school. And I mean, to the point where I was quite black and blue and afraid to say anything because they had threatened my life. And it was very bad. And finally, one day, I had to go for a physical to the doctor, and when I disrobed, I mean, it was quite obvious that something terrible was happening to me. And finally, I broke down after a lot of questioning and told him what the problem was. And they called my parents, and when they saw what I looked like, they were quite hysterical. And we have the police at the school, and the kids were expelled, and it was quite an ugly situation, which made me even more unpopular with their friends and the other people, you know. But so I had to go through, like I said, the next 2 years of school with that stigma attached to me.
Have you ever gotten the chance to see any of those guys who beat you up since you've become a famous actor?
I have. I've seen them in theaters that I've played.
Have you really?
Yeah, and different situations, and I don't think they actually knew who I was.
Oh, that's too bad.
I knew that I had, in a way, had the last laugh. It did make me feel good, because I'm never the type of person to seek revenge and things, but it's that they did really mess my mind up for a while, and my teenage years, you know, which were supposed to be the best years of your life.
Did you love movies when you were growing up? What were some of your favorite films?
I've always had a very macho taste in movies. my favorites then when I was a kid were those Knights of the Round Table movies and war movies. And,
really?
Yeah. I still like a good war movie. I mean, Platoon and all those movies I loved. And I really do like Rambo movies and Sylvester Stallone. And Charles Bronson, I think, is probably my favorite.
So you probably really enjoy playing heavies when you get the chance to do that.
Yeah. I'd like to play in some of those movies, you know, where they kill 150 people in the first 2 minutes of film. It really does relieve, you know, any frustrations you might have, I think.
So you liked really war movies and action films. Did you like glamour movies when you were growing up?
Well, anything that Elizabeth Taylor was in, I liked.
Did you like her better when she was thin or heavy?
It didn't matter to me.
Uh-huh.
Didn't matter. I thought it was just more of her to look at when she got heavy. But still very beautiful. And I finally did meet her one day, and I couldn't speak at all. I mean, after years of planning what I was going to say to her, I was blah, 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 blah. So I don't drink, but I went and had a double scotch and came back and had a little conversation with her.
Did she know you?
She knew of me. It was a party for her daughter, Maria, and her hairdresser and makeup man, a man, were people that I've used. And they had told her all about me, so she wanted to meet me at the party.
That's great that you'd use the same makeup man.
Yeah. We look a lot alike.
I recorded that interview with Divine on February 23rd, 1988. He died 2 weeks later at the age of 42. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what stories do you have on the execution of the Romanian dictator Nicolae Ceausescu?
Terry, John Hockenberry, who's been standing by in Yugoslavia waiting to get in, did get in, and we'll have a report from John Hockenberry on the reaction of people there. We're also going to take a look at the secret police, the Securitate, who they are and why they have the kind of power that they seem to have in the country, and looking at a reaction in China to the fall of Ceausescu. The Chinese, as you know, considered him a great friend of their country. And then on the other side, we'll be following the story in Panama once again.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Like Stonehenge, the carved stone heads on Easter Island in the Pacific have fascinated outside observers for centuries. Various theories exist about their origins and meaning. The explorer and scientist Thor Heyerdahl has written a new book called Easter Island, The Mystery Solved. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
I've been reading Thor Heyerdahl since I was a kid, and I'm a better person for it. By accident, of course. The Norwegian biologist and geographer taught me that the modern contempt for ancient people and the Eurocentric contempt for different races and cultures were equally stupid, that some of the greatest detective stories are written on wind and water and rock, and that it was possible to be a hero without killing anybody. In Kon-Tiki, Aku Aku, and the Ra expeditions, I sailed with him on reed vessels from Mesopotamia to the Indus Valley, from Asia to Africa, from Africa to America. In an Inca-type balsa raft, I left Peru for Polynesia. Anything was possible, and had been for thousands of years. Last summer in Oslo, I stared for the first time at his frail craft. It was like shaking hands with my lost childhood, with Captain Kangaroo. The great stone heads of Easter Island have obsessed him for more than 30 years. Who made them, and why? And how did they move around, on the chessboard of the island, blind under their top hats, immemorial with their goofy abstract look, looking a lot to the innocent eye like dream compounds in black rock of cubism and penguins, Charles Adams and Bob Hope. Easter Island, The Mystery Solved, looks like a coffee table book. Certainly the photographs are gorgeous, but it's much, much more. It's history, carbon dating back at least as early as 386 A.D. It's religion, telling us of long-eared, sun-worshipping priest kings, their birdman cults, their ancestor worship, and their megalithic architecture. It's anthropology, the red hair and white skin of many of the islanders, the enigmatic petroglyphs, the cat-like figurines, moon shapes and ball shapes and Rongo Rongo tablets. It's botany. Any fool, we're told, can make an arrowhead, but only God can make a sweet potato. And it's maritime science. The original islanders came down from the Andes in pre-Inca times to sail westward in their reed boats with double-bladed paddles from the coast of Peru 2,000 miles toward a setting sun god. Thor, I call him Thor because we've been so intimate in the library, Thor lets us in on each European invasion of this aboriginal culture, from the first Dutch ship on Easter morning 1722 to the Spanish in 1770, Captain Cook 4 years later after some awful civil war, slave-raiding Peruvians, Christian missionaries who burned the tablets, capitalist exploiters who burned native huts to make room for copra and sheep, scholarly Germans, and the amazing Mrs. Rutledge. If anybody had listened to the islanders, they'd have known that the long ears came first from Peru, that short-eared Polynesians followed, perhaps as slaves, that the great stone heads honor ancestors instead of imagining gods, and that once upon a time there were eyes in those sockets. But Europeans had their own theories, rooted in contempt, which one by one Thor demolishes, on the evidence of magic stones, boat-shaped houses, secret caves, grotesque carvings, sacred history, masks, and circumcision. I won't tell you how the stone giants walked out of the crater walls and into our feverish dreams. Read Thor for yourself. But the Druids didn't do it, and neither did a lost tribe of Israel, and neither did the Martians, and neither did Eric von Daniken. This is wonderful stuff.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Easter Island, The Mystery Solved, by Thor Heyerdahl. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tui and Roberta Shorrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, more interviews from the Fresh Air archives. Composer John Cage talks about chance processes, and composer David Del Tredici tells us why he returned to tonality. Also, actor and writer Wallace Shawn elaborates on some of the ideas he expressed in his film My Dinner with Andre. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.